All right, we are live.
Yeah, we're live. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the Energy Realities Podcast with David Blackman, Tammy Nemeth, Stu Turley, and me, Irina Slav. And today we're discussing the challenges to net zero. There isn't a shortage of those, and it seems like they're multiplying by the day. Let's start with you, Tammy. What do you think are the biggest obstacles on the road to hell? I mean, heaven, net zero heaven. Sorry.
Oh, there's so many. It's hard to choose. I think the biggest one, and maybe it hasn't got as much play in the United States as it has over here in Europe, I think it's the reaction of the people. And if you look at what's happening with the farmer protests that are ongoing, and I guess Emmanuel Macron showed up at a French agricultural show and the farmers were all chanting against him. And he's like, oh, it's okay. I'm looking out for you. We're going to do maybe a minimum price for agricultural goods and all this kind of thing. But what they're failing to at least put out in the news is that the reason why the farmers are angry is that the Common Agricultural Program in the European Union paid farmers to farm, basically, and there's a system of subsidies and so on. But now, in order to get that money, farmers have to prove that they're being sustainable, and there's a whole bunch of green measures they have to prove they're doing in order to qualify for the money they used to get for just farming. And so the farmers are like, oh my gosh, we have to fill out all this paperwork. How do we confirm to you, EU bureaucrat, that we're actually doing all these different things? We need certification and all this. And that's just to get paid the money that you would normally have gotten. And so the farmers are like, holy crap, we can't do this. We can't afford this red tape. And how are we going to implement all of these green measures? And that's what the protests are really about. But you don't hear that. Instead, it's right. Like, oh, we're going to double down and be more sustainable in agriculture and so on and so forth. And so I think once people start to wake up that these policies will reduce the food supply, it'll make your groceries more expensive, it'll make fuel more expensive, which makes everything more expensive, then people will get upset. Unfortunately, and I have to give a shout out to Tom Nelson's podcast, because he was talking to Rupert Darwell the other day, and Rupert was going on about how it's not like the politicians don't have this information about the challenges, whether it's minerals or farming or fuel and all these different kinds of stuff. They're just choosing not to listen. They're choosing not to pay attention. To me, the biggest challenge, because it's a road to disaster for people, because the cost of living goes crazy.
Why would they make a conscious choice to not listen, to not take into account these considerations, you know, David?
Well, because they're being rewarded for doing so in one way or another, some form or fashion, in ways that
corruption.
Well, you know, in the U.S. Congress, it's via insider trading information. That's quite obvious, a big racket in the U.S. Congress. And, you know, you get promised board seats, very lucrative positions on corporate boards when you leave the Congress, if you do certain things and vote a certain way. And it's all about making money and setting themselves up for an easy retirement after they've served three or four terms. It's why you see now, 20 years ago, the U.S. Congress, people held on to seats in the House of Representatives for as long as they could. They never wanted to leave. You wanted to get to at least 10 terms and 20 years in Congress so that you would retire for full retirement benefits, congressional retirement benefits. Today, congressional retirement benefits are chicken feed compared to what these people can make with insider trading deals, lucrative real estate propositions that come their way for voting a certain way on certain issues. And of course, that, you know, being paid several hundred thousand dollars a year to sit on a corporate board and work 8 or 10 days a year. And so, you know, it's not about that anymore. It's why we see every election cycle now, 30 or 40 incumbent members of Congress voluntarily giving up their seats, many of them leaving their seats before their term is up, you know, in order to go cash in on the deals they've made in exchange for votes and supporting certain positions on bills. Everything is corrupt now. The whole process is corrupt. And that's why you see these people, you know, voting ways that seem very odd to you in terms of how they promised to govern when they ran for office, and very inconsistent with the supposed party philosophy and the party that they're members of. The whole proposition, value proposition of being a member of Congress has changed. And I'm sure it's the same way at the EU, being a member of the European Commission or being a member of Parliament in most European countries. The whole process has been corrupted to push these policies. When these people know better, you catch these members of Congress, particularly Republicans, in private times and have a conversation with them about it, they say all the right things. They understand that these policies are all terrible for the average person in the country, but they have all kinds of bad incentives to support these policies. And, you know, it's mainly about personal enrichment and taking care of their own families as everything goes to hell around them.
Yeah, but when it goes to hell around them, it will go to hell for them too.
Yeah. I think there's a general lack of understanding. Yeah, they think they're going to be allowed to become part of the big club, right? The elite big club. When in reality, you know, they're going to make a few million dollars and be forgotten about as soon as they leave the Congress.
So they think they will be insulated, but they won't.
But they won't be
insulated. I don't think they will be insulated either. I think they think of themselves as, you know, the elite, the chosen ones. As was it John Kerry who called himself and the rest of them the chosen ones?
The chosen ones, yes.
Yeah, they'll just go and hide in a bunker somewhere, and they'll have all the food they need because they'll be able to afford it while we starve and die on the streets. But this is not how revolutions work. And if they keep going this way, as Tammy said, I think people are already starting to wake up to the reality, because I'm sure you've seen all the polls that say, you know, people very much care about the environment and about climate change. But when you ask them to make specific sacrifices for net zero, and they stop caring this much. Do you care about the environment, Stu?
Absolutely. But, you know, when you sit back and take a look, I get all worked up, and I have to give a shout out to Thomas Stepstone. He has a Substack that went out on. Isn't he cool?
Yeah, he's great.
In fact, I'd love to get him on the realities here. So we'll get him on. What the heck is Ukraine really about? And it's about Kerry's stepson, and it goes into the hypocrisy that we're all talking about Heinz, about all this kind of stuff. This is a beautiful article, and I'll make sure that the team puts it in the show notes on this thing when it goes out. The Secret Empires. And when the bad goes bad, they're going to throw you out with the bathwater. It's not going to happen. And Tammy, Rupert Darwall, I reached out to him to interview him as well, too, a while ago. So I'm going to reach back out. I loved the topics that you were talking about with him. He's a cool cat.
Yeah, he's really knowledgeable. He's written, you know, Green Tyranny and another book about the whole history of the climate movement and its intersection with the politics and this path to net zero that's evolved, I suppose.
One of them came out.
I wanted to point out to Irina and David, you know, and used to Mark Rutte, who lost, you know, in Holland, he's still the leader technically, but, you know, his party lost in the elections and so on. But he's doing a soft landing because they're talking him up to be the new head of NATO. So,
well, of course.
Oh, yeah, that's because Ursula von der Leyen is eyeing a second term as EC president.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard she was one of the possible candidates for NATO. But, yeah, she's probably busy campaigning for a second term as president of the commission.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, and isn't that the same thing that happened with what was the guy's name, Timmerman? who was the former head of the
EC, yeah,
who suddenly becomes president of Poland in a very
He's Dutch, and he took over the leadership of the Left Alliance in Holland.
And here's a guy that just took over as president of Poland, who was a
Donald Tusk.
Tusk. Okay. Yeah. I mean, they all
in power before he's back into in power now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, with Timmermans, he could very well end up being the leader of Holland because Geert Wilders can't form a coalition. So then it'll be like Poland, where you have these parties that came in second, third, and fourth, who all get together, and suddenly they're running the show.
Yeah.
And even though people didn't. You know, the more seats went to the other party, but the other party is considered toxic or whatever, and then nobody wants to form a coalition. I mean, that's one of the benefits, I think, of first past the post and only two parties, which has its own problems.
That's true, because it's really outrageous in Bulgaria. I think I've mentioned it before, but the two parties that formed the coalition were campaigning against each other in the run up to the elections. Yes.
Really?
Yes, really.
Wow.
Imagine how many voters got stung. They got lied to, and then they pretended it didn't happen. It was necessary to have a regular government. No, it wasn't. Not this way. But it's about corruption, as David very aptly described.
And the two-party system doesn't really insulate you from that. I mean, we're already seeing now articles in publications, Democratic leaning publications like The Atlantic, New York Times, Washington Post, setting the stage and the rationale up for a Democrat majority in Congress, assuming the Democrats regain control of the House of Representatives, refusing to certify a Donald Trump victory next January in the Electoral College, because Donald Trump led this fictional insurrection in 2021 that they have, you know, maintained this fiction for all these years now. You know, and so the two-party system doesn't really insulate you from that. If you, as long as you have people who are audacious enough and willing to corrupt and ignore the institutions that have formed this country and governed this country forever, as long as you have a political party that's willing to simply, I mean, we just saw Joe Biden brag about ignoring an order from the Supreme Court on student loans last week. I mean, they brag about it. So as long as you have, when you have a political party that's willing to just discard everything and a Justice Department that refuses to enforce the law, you can, you know, the two-party system doesn't really insulate you from the same thing, problems you end up with a parliamentary system.
Yeah, it's still corruption, right? Because they'll enforce the law against people they want. You know, it's two-tiered justice. And so it's the erosion of the democratic values, right? And I think part of the thing with net zero is that too is an erosion of democratic values. People say they don't really want it. They say, why aren't you looking at the engineering studies that say we don't have enough minerals to do what you think we need to do? And all these different kinds of things. And so then I think that creates this idea that democracy's failing. And you see that a lot coming up in the news that, oh, democracy's in question, democracy's not working, capitalism's the problem. It's like, well, no, it isn't. Capitalism's fine. Democracy can be fine. It's the people that are running the show who are choosing not to be democratic and choosing not to follow the so-called capitalist system we're supposed to be under, but haven't really been for ages. So
they're ignoring all these challenges, they're ignoring all the problems,
right?
How long can this continue, I wonder?
I don't know. Good question. I mean, you know, in Canada they were saying that the premier of Alberta and the premier of Saskatchewan were being lawless, because they were saying these resources are our constitutional jurisdiction and we're going to keep the power plants going because we have an obligation to our citizens and it's within our rights in the Constitution to do it. And Trudeau and his environment minister, Stephen Guilbeault, were saying, well, you're being lawless. You're being lawless. And then you have the case that you're talking about, David, where here you have the left being completely lawless and bragging about it, right? And So I find it interesting that they accuse Donald Trump of having incited an insurrection. But isn't it an insurrection to not certify the results of a duly elected candidate?
Of course it is. Yeah. But I mean, they engage in projection like that all the time where they, you know, they're being accused of acting in a certain way, and they accuse their opponents of being the ones who are really doing it in order to deflect attention from their own malpractice. And when you own 98% of the news media, you can get away with that, which is the case with the Democrats in the United States. I assume it's probably that way with Trudeau's party in Canada as well.
Well, they pay the media. They support it.
Yeah, they actually fund the media, which Congress wanted to do through the IRA. And luckily that language got stripped out of the IRA. But
they just get financed by the same people as the media.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's basically they're making it official that there's a double standard. It's one standard for us because we're the good guys, and there's another standard for the bad guys. And the bad guys are the ones we say are the bad guys. Exactly. Same with forest clearing, this recent example about those citizens of a town near Berlin who voted against an expansion of the Tesla Gigafactory because it would involve clearing, what was it, 100 acres of forest, and people were against it. And it's just the latest example of these double standards. Deforestation is very, very bad, but if we're expanding a gigafactory for EVs, then it's fine, it's necessary, and nobody minds it from the government. And this is why these challenges we mentioned are not going to go away. They're only going to get worse.
Yeah.
What are we going to
do then? Well, in Canada, something similar happened where there's the government is funding these big EV battery factories. And there was one in Quebec where they would have to, you know, destroy a bunch of forest. And it's not like Canada's lacking forests, to be honest, to be fair. we'd have to cut down a whole bunch of forest area in order to build this this battery plant. And the environmental groups got a court injunction to stop the building of the battery plant while they do an environmental impact assessment on, you know, cutting down the trees. So, like you said, it's a bit of a double standard where the government wants this. They want people to stop cutting down trees, but then they'll do it for EV factories.
Yeah, but it's good that the environmentalists stepped in because some environmentalists don't care about this. You know, they say it's good to cut down trees if it's for a good purpose, such as an EV factory or whatever, or a wind farm. But at least these environmentalists are the right kind, that they protect nature as is. Yeah.
Stu, you were trying to get in a minute ago.
Sorry.
I'm just having a lot of fun this morning, guys. You guys are on a roll. I'm usually the one out in left field. You guys are doing quite well without me. Good morning to Robert. I would really
Robert DeMonaco, yes.
Yes. Don't want to butcher his name. I saw him come rolling through.
Day Domenico. I'm sorry. I said DeMonaco. It's Day Domenico. Sorry.
Yep.
Morning.
And
it seems that it's the oil and gas industry that's the biggest obstacle to net zero, don't you think?
Yes.
Not just the villain. It is the biggest problem.
Victor Garcia hits the nail on the head here. Net zero is a wealthy elite's dream. That is correct.
It's the wealthy elites who have forgotten what it is to not take things for granted because they take everything for granted.
Be happy because I tell you to. I think that's like being a husband. right?
Isn't that the thing? You'll have nothing and be happy?
I think so.
You will own nothing.
I just translated to...
Did he really say this?
Yes, he did. He absolutely did say that at 2021. 2021.
Oh.
Yeah. No, that was Klaus Schwab. Yeah.
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 Peter just said Javier Milei's speech. Is that this one?
Yeah.
Whoop. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, I agree. and his speech at CPAC over the weekend too. He made many of the same points.
Okay, but, shall we go to the headlines? Sorry, Stu.
You bet. Let me show you what this is. What I feel about net zero. I visited with Gregory Wrightstone several times and the CO2 coalition. So let's just leave off the table whether CO2 is actually bad or not, because plants actually like it. And in Scotland, was it a couple of years ago, they had to pull 14 million trees down for their wind farms.
Yeah.
So
Scotland doesn't have a lot of trees.
No, I found that kind of amazing. But here we go, guys. This is the road to net zero. Today only on the Energy Reality Podcast.
Wonder what the carbon footprint of that is.
It's probably a sabotage from the oil industry.
I'm sure it is. Yeah.
No, yeah. I mean,
wind turbines are flawless. They never catch fire on themselves. Or somebody forgot to oil them
because
they weren't using
oil's bad.
This is the Biden administration calling for Irina Slav. They need a new press secretary and they want to interview you.
Oh, come on.
Maybe it was a kamikaze bird.
A bird strike. Yeah.
A climate denier bird.
Probably. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so are we doing the stories now?
Yeah.
Okay, who's the first victim?
Okay, so these are my stories. And the first one is AXA investment managers are going to vote against companies that lobby against climate goals. And I found this really interesting because basically if a company says, okay, you know what, we have a net zero plan, we're planning for 2050, and this is our process for getting there. But then the government changes the goalposts and says, no, we want you to do it till 2035. If the company then lobbies the government to say, you know, but we have this other plan for 2050, and you said that was the original goal, so we would like to continue moving towards 2050, AXA would vote against them because that would be considered lobbying against climate goals. And the way it's worded, it's very vague, so that you get this, the power of these institutional investors to be telling companies, you cannot lobby for your best interests and the interests of your shareholders if it goes against whatever arbitrary climate goals are being set by governments. So that is extremely problematic. And one of the things in Canada is that there's actually a bill before the Canadian Senate. It was introduced by a very radical senator, and it seeks to put that into law that will basically ban companies from lobbying against any climate goals. And if a company is found to be lobbying against it, there would be fines, and therefore you couldn't have board members who lobby and this kind of thing. So, I mean, it's really terrible. And then the second headline there says Environment Canada is seeking climate altering technology that blocks the sun. And so Environment Canada has actually cut down the number of weather stations that they fund in Canada. So they've closed weather stations down. They've cut the funding for weather stations, but now they're investing in research to put chemicals in the sky to block the sun. And
go wrong.
I just, what could go wrong, right?
Yeah.
Nothing.
So it's, you know, for one, if they're mad about CO2, they're mad about methane, both of which are naturally occurring and actually help trees grow and plants grow and so on and so forth. But now they want to fund research into putting other particles into the sky that could potentially be devastating. So.
But those would be good particles because the goal is noble. We'll have this double standards.
Yeah.
Irina, I still think you would make a much better press secretary for the president of the United States than what we have. Well done. Way to say it. Great job.
Yep. Good job.
Stu, the neighbors 10-year-old grandson will make a better presidency than the person currently in this position. Honestly, this is, I'm so sorry for you guys. I'm so sorry this is happening in your country.
Honestly. I didn't vote for her.
Yeah, well, but she's still a government employee, you know, of your federal government. Yeah, you pay her salary.
Repeatedly.
Yeah.
All right.
Who's next?
Who's up next? Oh. wait. That was a good point. Anagrams.
Playing with letters.
Net zero anagrams to erase 10, sort of like erase, 1 of 10, decimate. And it's followed by decimation was Roman military punishment practice of killing every 10th soldier. Yeah, it does,
well, it's a good thing there's only four of us today.
We don't qualify yet, right?
Yeah, we don't qualify.
Oh, my goodness. That's hilarious. Thank you, Robert.
Great job, Robert. Fine.
All right, Irina's turn.
Okay, charging void has drivers trying new routes to power up. This comes from the UK, where there are not enough public charges and not enough people owning EVs living in their own houses where they could charge their EVs. So there's a whole new business booming in the UK. People renting their chargers. Their house charges to other people in the area, I presume. There's also something called mobile charging, which wasn't elaborated on, so I have no idea how this works.
Oh, that's a diesel generator waiting to happen, what that sounds like.
I didn't think about that because they're calling it mobile. Yeah, I thought somehow, you know, via Wi-Fi, I don't know. But
these
platforms, online platforms emerging where you could get connected with a charger owner so you can, you know, drive past their house and charge your car. I'm not sure how it works because the article also mentions that home chargers don't really charge very quickly. So if you're doing this, you'll have to leave your car for the whole day, or maybe the night. I don't know how this works, but people are finding ways. People really want their EVs, and they're finding ways to charge them in the absence of sufficient public charging capacity available. And that's
it sounds like we need a Tinder app for chargers, right?
That's exactly how it sounded. Right? Yes, I was thinking about the name of the thing, the dating app for chargers. Yeah. Meanwhile, across the channel, the EU industry calls for green shift help to rival China and the US. And
sorry, Irina, I didn't mean to interrupt, but watch this. This is an EV.
It's mobile charging?
Yeah, this is an EV bus charger on diesel.
Of course.
Well, it's mobile.
It is mobile.
Yes, it's mobile.
Sorry, I didn't mean to. Let me remove it here. Sorry.
Yeah, well, keep it simple when we can make it as complicated as possible. Yeah, so the European businesses are calling on Brussels to do an European industry deal or something. But they're basically asking for more money. They want more money, they want cheap energy, and they want more climate change targets. I'm not sure how all these work together, but they're really insisting that they want cheap energy. And I laughed, I admit, when I read this because, you know, we want cheap energy. Give us cheap energy. How?
Yeah.
How? Exactly.
I mean, the European Union has done its best to give them cheap energy, all this wind, all this solar capacity, and still they're not happy and they want their energy even cheaper. And they want more money and less bureaucracy.
Right.
Can you imagine?
And protection from Chinese competition.
and protection and more subsidies,
yeah,
to be able to compete better with US and Chinese products because of all those subsidies that US and China are giving out to companies and the EU is not. Am I mad or is the EU giving out plenty of money in the form of all sorts of subsidies and still it's
but
not
it'll never be enough. It'll never be enough. It'll never be enough. They will always come back for more. And when the companies start going bankrupt, they will come back in for bailouts on top of the subsidies.
Yeah, and, because it's not their fault. It's not the company's fault.
Right.
Yeah.
Energy is really, really very expensive. And this makes products and services non-competitive.
Irina, do you think with the things that are going on, we have Ford, you have Mercedes-Benz, you have all these others that are now canceling their EV plans and starting to follow in Toyota. Toyota's got the hybrid model that they're really rolling. Yeah. I've been a big Toyota hybrid fan. Let's support, you know, hey, if I'm all in on 60 miles per gallon on gas, but not having to stop by a charger. But do you think with Mercedes-Benz backpedaling and Ford backpedaling, those are the two biggies that are saying that they're having to really cut out of EVs?
Well, it's not just them. It's everyone in the car making business.
Yeah.
Everyone is saying it already. Everyone is admitting it because it's impossible to hide. They're losing money and they're losing a lot of money. So they have to admit it. They have shareholders. And the shareholders are probably not very happy with them.
Probably and the Ford not. Mustang this week, this past week, they said $8,100 for the GE model, the Mustang, so it'd get it down to $50,000. However, it does not qualify, even though it's an American-made car, for the $7,000 tax incentive. So they had to reduce the price, and they're losing $64,000 for every EV they sell. They're now losing $93,000 for every Ford E model they sell. I was like, I cannot even imagine this.
Isn't it great that they're still selling a lot of internal combustion engine cars to, you know, to offset the losses from their EVs?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's a good racket while your shareholders and investors are willing to put up with it. But they're, you know, they're going to have a limited patience with that. And I think that's why we're seeing these automakers begin to back off of these aggressive goals because they're, you know, their investors are saying, hey,
it makes zero sense.
Yeah, $5.7 billion in losses. I don't care if we made 12. If we made 12 in the gas models, you know, we're still down to $5 billion profit when it could have been 15 if we weren't doing all this EV crap. And investors and shareholders are going to have very limited patience with that.
Hopefully.
And they should, by the way. They should have very limited patience with that.
Well, I put in the little chat there the wise words from Doomberg, which is energy is not an input into the economy. It is the economy. Yeah. And I think that ties into what you were saying, Irina, about, you know, these EU companies want all this assistance, you know, to lower energy costs because that's the economy. If you don't have reasonably priced energy,
exactly,
the economy sucks.
Right. We are seeing that with the deindustrialization of Germany.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Rivian will go bankrupt. Robert, you're right about that. They're on the verge. Yeah. Fisker will go back. Every pure play EV company making cars in the United States will be bankrupt by the end of next year. Take it to the bank. The companies that are legacy automakers who can offset multi-billion dollar losses on their electric models with profits on gas power cars are going to be able to continue to do that as long as their shareholders and investors allow it. But we're already seeing the investors and shareholders start to rebel. And so this whole EV thing, other than Tesla, is going to have a complete retrenchment in the United States over the next 2 years. And in the meantime, China is establishing factories, EV factories in Mexico to provide their gateway into the United States, because the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement contains all these exceptions and openings that contradict the stuff in the IRA that was designed to prevent China from coming into our market. They can come into our market in the U.S. through Mexico, and that's what's going to happen. And so as these EV companies are going bankrupt and out of business, cheap Chinese EVs are going to start pouring into the United States, just as they're pouring into Europe right now.
Yeah.
Well, there still won't be enough chargers. So, you know, demand, won't, be demand won't be. I'm perfectly serious. If you don't have the infrastructure, right, they'll run into the same problems that current EV hopefuls are running into.
Yep.
With the only advantage of price.
Robert had another good comment. Whatever coffee, Robert, you're on, I'd love to have some.
The EV business. Oops. I'm sorry, Stu. We were trying to do it at the same time there. EV business, like buying eggs at a dime a piece, selling them for a nickel and expecting to make up the difference in volume. Yep.
Yeah.
That's it.
Precisely.
Great business model.
Whatever coffee, Robert, you're on, I want some.
Yeah. Must be Black Rifle.
I think so. He's actually smart. All right. Who's next? Next
that
victim?
Would be you or me. Oh, it's me. Oh, boy. Oh, my
the
God.
Bunny. The bunny.
The bunnies. Oh, my God. Hopefully many of you viewers got to read the op-ed in the Washington Post written by a guy who, I swear to God, I kid you not, his job title is, what is it? Climate advice columnist. Okay. He is the Dear Abby of the climate movement. Okay. His job is to give you advice, personal advice on how to control your carbon footprint. And this week's advice was to get rid of your dogs and cats. I guess you just put them to sleep or whatever, because their carbon footprint's too big, because they are carnivores. They eat a lot of meat, and that's bad. You know, eating meat is bad. I'm sure this guy's a vegan himself. And you're going to replace your dog with a damn rabbit. Okay? Because rabbits are vegetarians. I swear to God. That's what you just can't make this stuff up. It's the greatest thing I ever read. And the worst thing I ever read at the same time, because he's dead serious. I mean, this guy lives for this kind of stuff. Okay. And so you're gonna replace Fido with Mr. Squeezy the bunny, who doesn't do anything except sit around eating hay and leftover
and
lettuce
all the time.
And pooping pellets. I mean, he said that one of the good things about a rabbit, though, is they will use a litter box. So you'll have that going for you. You get to repurpose your cat's litter box for your rabbit. So, you know, you save money there and you save carbon, and they probably don't toot as much. So there's not as much methane because they're not eating meat. And here's the thing about this. OK, we laugh, we joke about this stuff. That story did not materialize in this climate advice columnist's little tiny brain, okay? That story was handed to him by some activist group who got the idea from the sessions, literal sessions that were held at COP28 and the WEF conference in Davos this past year, okay? This is serious stuff. There's going to be a movement to pass laws in the coming years. Your governments are going to attempt to pass laws denying you the right to have a pet dog or cat because of their carbon footprint. And you may laugh about this and say I'm a conspiracy theorist, but I will guarantee you, check back in with me in 5 years and tell me that some member of your state legislature or member of Congress or member of parliament in Canada or one of the European countries, check in with me 5 years from now and tell me this hasn't happened, because it's going to happen. This is a very highly organized effort. So don't just chuckle about this and forget about it.
David, I don't know that we don't need a rabbit.
Yes. So oh, yeah. Well, this is the rabbit video.
Dismount! This is what Irina loves, Tammy. Okay. Yeah. Now, this is too long. But we're going to zip in here. What is the money?
There he is. Where?
There's Mr. Fluffy.
What, behind the
rabbit? Right. Okay, I'm going to move forward just for time. Ah! Well,
it's always a...
Yeah, you're missing
the
bunny.
I'm
sorry.
I want me a bunny. Okay, I got to have me a bunny, baby. If they're going to put my garden dog away, got to have me a bunny. Sorry, guys. I had to do that.
I agree with David. It is serious, and it is, probably yes. will happen in one form or another. Maybe they'll make us pay taxes for cats and dogs, carbon taxes. And it goes with the activist push to discourage people from having children, because children have a massive carbon footprint too.
Right, exactly.
Especially when you got to change them. That's a heck of a footprint.
Yeah, and that's a, you know, a big part of the rationale but behind the Malthusian part of the climate alarmist movement. You know, you want to reduce the population because of their climate footprint or carbon footprint. Yeah. The other story there is about, this was another piece that was written, I think it was in Politico, and the writer is incredulous, you know, that in states where the Democratic Party has succeeded in pushing its climate action regulations into effect, utility bills have skyrocketed. And the writer was genuinely perplexed, okay? Because, you know, wind and solar are cheap. And he just couldn't understand why utility bills were rising faster in the states where Democrats, the blue states where Democrats reign, than in the red states where Republicans govern, okay? And haven't adopted these policies, at least not as rapidly as the Democrats have. And it, there's literally, and this is classic legacy mainstream news media reporting on climate change. It is that, well, you know, wind and solar are cheap, so the bill should be going down. Why aren't they going down? There's zero understanding that when you overload your grid with all this wind and solar, you have all these opportunity costs that are lost, and you're having to essentially fund two separate grids because you're funding the weather dependent grid that doesn't work, and it particularly doesn't work during times of severe weather events. And you have to have this second grid that you're also paying for that actually keeps the lights on and your heaters running, you know, in the middle of a big polar vortex or whatever we're calling those things now. So anyway, that one just cracked me up. It's a classic piece in our legacy media that shows zero understanding of what's really happening on our power grids.
Well, David, interestingly, in Canada, because they're really pushing heat pumps, and of course, heat pumps don't work when it's cold. And so the solution is that you have to have two heating systems. Yeah. You have to have the heat pump and then a backup, which is what they want to do with the grid. You want wind and solar, but you have to have an equivalent system ready to go when it's not working. So, which of course doubles the cost, if not more. And then people wonder, why is energy so expensive?
The great Meredith Angwin's book, Shorting the Grid, the formulas come out to 180% times instead of a 20% increase in additional requirements for downtime or emergencies. 20%, we can understand that. Got to have 180% when you add that. So shout out to Meredith Angwin, one of my heroes. Oh, sorry.
Okay, I'm done. Your turn, Stu.
All right. Let's start with Chicago sues oil companies for causing climate change, points to 1995 heat wave. I don't even know where to start on this one. We're sitting here talking about net zero. The man has got one of the worst crap. I mean, holes in the United States for a city, thanks to his running it. And he's leading a lawsuit against fossil fuels in the big oil companies to save the planet. The man is destroying Chicago. And in the name of net zero, he's trying to go after big oil. Mayor Brandon Johnson. It seeks relief in the form of hundreds of millions of dollars in compensatory and loss of use damages and penalties for fines for violations. Unbelievable. This man is just absolutely. Vic Shear is a partner at Shear Elding Speaks, the climate litigation he's involved with. This guy looks like he ought to be entertainment.
Yeah, well, they got to make some money, you know. Easiest way, sue big oil. They have money.
Well, yeah.
You got to win first, but if you win, you get some money off big oil.
And anyway.
They're not the only one. They're trying to put together a class action lawsuit in British Columbia to sue oil companies for the forest fires.
Exactly. Oh, sure. They're trying to turn them into
dairy
cows.
The environmental groups are going around trying to get the different cities and towns and municipalities to do a class action lawsuit against oil and gas companies. And they're using that attribution science, which is like I've read some of the studies and they're just ludicrous, but they're using those as a justification and rationale to sue the companies.
Usually not lost for words, but you know, I got videos of helicopters with napalm going by, and they had of the arsonists that were up there. Most of those were started by arson, left-wing Greenpeace tree-hugging people that were trying to do that. So now they're trying to sue the oil and gas companies for arson.
Well, for making the air so dry that the forest caught fire quicker.
No.
That's the reasoning. It's drying out the air. It's dry, that therefore dries out the forest and makes it easier to start on fire.
Irina, I think you're off the hook. I think you're off the hook. I think we got to get a hold of that legal department. They're our new spokesperson for the U.S. press secretary.
I'm surprised Chicago doesn't go back and sue Standard Oil for the Great Chicago Fire.
Wow. If that happens, everybody here heard it here first. That's a great idea, Tammy. Anyway, all right. CNN's attempt to smear India for purchasing Russian oil fell flat. This one really doesn't have anything to do with net zero. I just put it in there because I was like, this is absolutely the Indian prime minister was absolutely dead on right. And he said, basically, we're doing the best thing we can for our country. Have a great day. And CNN was just absolutely ludicrous. So anytime we can actually publish something from CNN and it's bad on their own self, you got to publish it. They're that bad. They thought it was a good story. And they're like, no, you're an idiot. You just published that you're an idiot. So, anyway, that's it for me.
But you know, that is part of net zero, though, because the West has been pushing India to invest in solar and wind and all this other crap. Robert Bryson's previous documentary went to some of these places in India where the environmentalists did this big thing where they had some solar panels and wow, they got to charge their phone for 10 minutes or something like that before it was all gone. And then the people rioted and said, we want to be connected up to the grid where it's reliable from coal. And there were all these riots going on in the Indian countryside. So, you know, Modi is kind of straddling that line where he wants the Western money to push the net zero agenda, but he still wants reliable energy and keeps investing in coal and buying oil and gas or whatever from Russia. So
that looks like a smart man. Maybe he'll make the right decision. That reliability is more important when you have more than a billion people.
Yeah. And an election this year.
I applaud world leaders that take care of their country first. And this wonderful authoress, let's see, Saudi Arabia can no longer raise oil output for cash. Oh, I think her name is Irina Slav, I think. But that was a great article talking about how the whole financial system of the billions of dollars of Saudi Arabia, they're really sitting back and saying, hey, we're not going to put into CapEx right now. Why should we let a good price hike coming around the corner in your article?
I don't think Irina wrote that piece. I saw that piece, though. That was a good story. It was at oilprice.com.
It must have been there, but was it about that project or?
Yeah, it was about Ben Salman noted that thanks to the current production curbs, there was a pretty soft cushion of around 3 million barrels of spare capacity. So they don't have
investing a lot of money in them.
In trillions, but they've got a way to manage it. They're not going to put the money back into the oil and gas yet. They're going to let the price grow. Their reserves are going to grow in value.
They don't really have a choice. If they want to continue with these projects, they need higher prices.
Right.
So they will just withhold production. Okay. Well, does anyone have any closing remarks?
Yes. Yes. Before we go, I just want to give everybody a heads up that next Monday morning we will be joined by the great Robert Bryce.
Yes. Yes.
Get his views on what's going on with the energy transition right now. Talk about his new wonderful documentary. You need to go watch this. It's free on YouTube. It's called Juice, Power Politics and the Grid. And it is one of the best documentaries about energy that has ever been, really, that's ever been created. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that. I don't give praise lightly. And it's really a fantastic product that everyone needs to watch. So we're really looking forward to having Robert with us next Monday.
Yes, we are. That would be fantastic.
Well, Irina, great job.
Oh, yes, great job today, Irina.
Trying to keep up
improvement over last week.
I mean, Tammy is so mean. Holy smokes. So we've got Robert Bryce next week. Yay! I love Robert.
Something to definitely look forward to. Okay, well, have a great week then, everyone.
See you guys later.
Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye. Thanks for all the comments.
Bye, everybody.